You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. Today we're going to discuss something that I'm pretty sure I'm not going to get it all in an hour, but it's something that I've been formulating and working on for some time now. I have a book coming out on the history of Ukrainian nationalist thought. The current publication date has been pushed back and pushed back and pushed back, and I'm getting quite impatient. Nevertheless, the situation in Ukraine from 1990 to today has been one of the great heartbreaks of my career. It's a waste of human potential. Today, Ukraine is a fourth world country, populated by the most educated population in the world. There are more people in Ukraine with advanced degrees per capita than in any other country. Tremendous natural resources, incredibly strategic location. I mean, I could go on and on. And the place has no functional economy, and its currency is worthless, and it's maintained by foreign aid. It's at the same level as Ghana or the Ivory Coast in terms of corruption and you know, doing business and everything else. It's the lowest you can get. And it's no accident that you have a communist party there that looks to the Soviet era as almost a golden age. And you really can't really blame them for that, because it was, compared with what they have gone through. What some people don't realize, let me first say that there's been a lot of romanticization of the Ukrainian nationalist movement today. Whether it be Svoboda or the right sector. And I have made it very clear on this show, my very first broadcast was on Ukrainian social nationalism. I am both a Ukrainian and a Russian nationalist. Those two things are not contradictory. I take Gogol's view, which he laid out early on in his career, that they are necessary complements to one another. And it's true that Russians, especially in the Petersburg era, have exploited Ukraine. And of course, the Soviet Union almost destroyed it. This is not the case for Moscow. Under Moscow, most of Ukraine was under Western powers. So clearly you have two different nations. You have two different languages. You have two different legal traditions. And there's no real denying this. And even, you know, regardless, it's still, you know, something subjectively understood by most Ukrainians outside of the Far East. It deserves its own patriarch. You know, it's an independent country and should be that. I've over and over again used Belarus as my model for what Ukraine should be. Ukrainian culture, regardless of your opinion on the matter, is extraordinary. It's highly literate. It's strongly agrarian. And starting in the 17th century, early 17th century, it's strictly Orthodox. I mean, to be Ukrainian is to be Orthodox. And in the battles with the Union, starting in 1595, and the irony today is that so many of the anti-Russian nationalists are all Unions, because that was to be Polish. That was to be anti-Ukrainian at the time. The entire debate was this mixing of ethnic and religious labels that Ukrainian nationalism first really developed in the polemics between Poland and Ukraine, between Catholicism and Orthodoxy. And so for Unionists to run the show today is really a joke. I don't believe those who are fighting, that were fighting in the streets in 2014 are nationalists. I don't know how they could be, since the number one plank in their program was to join the EU. So whatever they were anything but nationals. I know the intellectual tradition, and I think it's generally a positive thing. And the Cossack host never trusted Moscow, or certainly never Petersburg. Mazeppa was correct to side with Karl of Sweden. And what Peter did in response to this, once Karl was defeated, is nothing short of attempted genocide. Of course, you couldn't have genocide at the time because the states weren't that well organized, and you didn't have that kind of the bureaucratic apparatus or the scientific apparatus you would need to do something like that. I want to take Russian nationalists to task in recognizing that there was a big split between Muscovite Russia and Petrograd Russia. I want to take them to task in thinking that Ukraine should be absorbed into Russia. That, you know, there's no differences. That that nationalism there is just a union phenomenon. And I want to take Ukrainian nationalists to task in thinking that Russians, rather than the Petrogradian state or the Soviet Union, are the problem. When you read nationalists on both sides, their writings, their scholarship is identical. All you have to do is just exchange the names of the countries. And it's the same. True Ukrainian nationalism, and I have an entire book on this subject, is based on a distrust of the West, a distrust of, certainly a loathing of capitalism, a distrust of everything Roman Catholic, Union or otherwise. And the belief in Bandera himself believed that the West could never be trusted in the fight against Marxism. You know, Ukrainian nationalists cannot view Russians this way. And the fact of the matter is, a few years ago, a study was conducted by the Kiev Institute of Sociology that showed that throughout the country, pro-Russian attitudes are by far dominant. Now, this was prior to the events of 2014. Since then, of course, Russian media largely banned in the country. But even in Galicia, pro-Russian attitudes predominated by about 50%. Just slightly, a slight majority. And it makes perfect sense, of course, because the West is blamed, rightly so, for what happened to the country after 1990, where its economy was liquidated. And it continues to be drained by these vampires. Now, specifically, the topic of today is the desire of, really, the leader of the Ukrainian oligarchs, Kolomorsky, Igor Kolomorsky, also the head of the European Jewish Congress, Ukrainian Jewish Congress, his drive to create new Khazaria in Ukraine. This is a real, literal phenomenon. New Khazaria was one of the reasons that the riots of 2014 took place, and that Yanukovych was standing in the way of that. The dominance of the Chabad sect of the Hasidim in Ukraine is overwhelming. With its capital now in Dnipro, it used to be Odessa. But he had and has his own private army trained by the IDF. Underneath him is Gennady Korbin, who is essentially the leader of this force. It's a private army. Dmitry Yarosh of the right sector has his nephew is serving in the IDF. Baruch Firtov, another oligarch, was offering a reward for every Novorussian head. I mean, if you take a building, you get $10,000, you know, this kind of reward system. They have a Khazar special battalion. And it's headquartered in a place called the Menora Business Complex, which we'll get to in a little bit. But the Khazar Khanate was a Jewish oligarchy. And Judaism did penetrate the lower classes, but not to any great extent. And it didn't make any difference. It was the oligarchy. To be an oligarch was to be Judaic at the time. They never relied on their own people. They didn't trust them. And they really aren't Khazars. I mean, this is a sort of an ethnic group. But their empire was so multifaceted that they didn't really have a people. So they relied on mercenaries. And that's very much the same today. The belief that Glumovsky and really the Chabad sect in general holds is that Israel in the Middle East, the country, doesn't have law. That the population dynamics are such that they will be overwhelmed. That the constant state of warfare means that they can't ever develop economically. That they're completely reliant on their domination of the American political process. All of these are negatives. All of these are things that they can't have and they can't rely on. And what few people know is that the Zionist movement in the 1920s saw the Crimea as an alternative to the Middle East, especially since Palestine was under British control. That Khazaria was always very, very close to the Jewish memory. But something else about the Khazar system that deserves mention, and that is that the Kagan didn't have tons of power. There was always this notion that Jewish financial oligarchy has to work behind the scenes. You know, the dog star Sirius has its invisible Sirius B, always a symbol of the Gnostic. And that relationship is taken very seriously. That there was a Beck, the viceroy, I guess you could call him a prime minister, who was strictly Jewish. It was a hereditary office. And it was in charge of pretty much everything. And it ruled, especially the military apparatus. Orthodox people in the Middle Ages saw Khazaria as Antichrist. And they weren't kidding about this, even in the West, because the mercenaries that they hired were often hired for the reputation for bloodthirstiness. They're killing for the sake of killing. Oligarchy in Ukraine is extremely Jewish. There's no question about this. Joseph Zissel, head of the Zionist Committee, Leo Feinberg, the head of the Center for Judaic Studies, close to the State Department, Bernard Levy, Eth Bashinsky, who was a banker. He was in charge of the snipers that were shooting people during Maidan. Poroshenko, who also has a Jewish background. Fritash Boglubov, which is an ironic name. Sirkisov, Yaroslavsky, Zhvago. All of these are Jewish oligarchs. And these, of course, are the rulers of the country. The right sector being the mercenary army that they used. Timoshenko has a Jewish background. Arsen Yatsenyuk, as many of you know, comes from a family of rabbis. Tianenbok, another so-called nationalist leader, has a Jewish background. In fact, his grandmother's name is Frothman. And the structure of their control is almost total. Viktor Pinchuk controls much of the press. Poroshenko, president, whose family name is Waltzman, owns Fifth Channel Television. Konstantin Zhivago controls the newspapers. Then you have people like, you know, Andrei Berevsky, Chernovetsky, my God, you know, Pertash is another major media mogul. Alexei Feldman, Mikhail Kipperman. And they predominate in two important industries, media and fuel. Of all sorts of, you know, oil, gas, and refining, etc. And they form, and they have formed, more or less informally, but still, an oligarchy called New Khazaria. And this is being said openly on Ukrainian television, and because the media in Ukraine is completely Jewish-owned. Russian media is largely prescribed, although not necessarily by law. And the notion of New Khazaria is becoming more and more common. Israel has been disappointing, you know, as a country. It's too small. It's surrounded by enemies, and the Palestinians are still in refugee camps. It's increasingly hard to defend, and the population dynamics are not in their favor. So the Crimea, generally speaking, the old territory of the Khazar Empire is being seriously thrown around as a possibility of a new Israel. They call it New Zion, or New Khazari is a more common name. And settlers from Israel have actually arrived, and they are building this. As far as the nationalist movement is concerned, I've always been highly sympathetic to it. The only time I have a problem with it is when it just believes that Russians are just, you know, inherently evil, or that they're Tartar Mongols, which is actually a common theme despite the scientific evidence, which overwhelmingly shows them to be of, you know, Aryan background. You know, I've cited, you know, dozens of studies already, and I can keep going in English, Russian, and Ukrainian. It just, you know, there's simply nothing more I can do. There is no Asiatic blood in the Russian population. But today's nationalist movement is open to question, the right sector in particular. I've read, of course, at one time or another, all of their material. And they're referencing, you know, it's a Zionist group. I mean, they reference Israel all the time as a model to follow. Just briefly, let me, you know, the Ukrainian government structure, again, which is not very important. It's a strongly presidential system in the sense that the president appoints the prime minister, and the prime minister has to be approved by the Rada or the parliament. Now, it used to be that the 450 members, half of them were elected in winner-take-all districts, the other half in proportional representation. Before 2006, after 2006, they went to all proportional representation, which, by the way, I've always liked that. If you're going to have a democratic system, that would be the way to go. Though in Ukraine, it's always very awkward because you don't have strong political parties. Party membership in Ukraine is minimal. Parties never quite took there as ideological movements. They usually are just vehicles for a very wealthy person or a wealthy faction. And they don't often have real ideological, you know, read the program of the Party of Regions and you're not very impressed by it. It's really, they don't say very much. It's almost just a place to keep your paperwork. Now during the riots of 2014, the rioters forced the state to go back to the pre-06 constitution. But again, I don't think it's very important because the power in Ukraine is purely economic. And the power in Ukraine is to be found at the menorah business district on the Dnieper River. And it just so happens, of course, to be the headquarters of the Chabad Hasidic sect was going to, prior to the riots, change its, was going to leave the U.S. and set up shop at its central place there. Rabbi Schneerson was actually from Nikolaev, which is right close by. The menorah complex is extraordinary. It is the largest Jewish community center in the world. It has a 5-star hotel. It has, I believe, the biggest Holocaust museum in the world. It has all manner of, you know, business offices. It's massive. And it's multi-billions. And it's actually shaped like a menorah. The structure of the buildings looks like one. And this is the headquarters of New Khazaria, and that this was constructed with that in mind. The menorah park is really an extraordinary thing. There's nothing like it in Israel. There's nothing like it in America. And of course, it's dedicated to Rabbi Schneerson and the entire Chabad notion. This, of course, you're not going to read about it in the American press, but this is the center of Ukraine. Because the economic power is what matters. That matters in most places. But given how ethnic the money is, that when you have a place like this, which is so, you know, blatant and it's just, it's opulence. It's extremely impressive. And people coming in, this is why you're getting settlers from Israel now. But we don't have to worry about, you know, getting shot there so much. It used to be that Odessa was the capital of European Jewry, and that's certainly true. And you're not really that far away, but this is going to be the center of New Khazaria. And the Zionist movement is shifting its focus. The right sector is not an anti-Judaic party. Kolomoisky has financed the party. He said very clearly that although they were fascists at one time, they no longer are. And their electoral fortunes are all over the place. In the 2012 elections, the Party of Regions got like 30%. The Communist Party got roughly 13%. And Svoboda got about 10%, which was the best that they have ever done. In 07, they got 0.76%. In 2010, when Chanbok ran for president, he got 1.43% of the votes. Their headquarters, really, when their base of operations is in Eastern Galicia, and they usually get roughly 25% of the vote there. And the Yatsenyuk government, after the riots in 2014, after March, had three members of the Svoboda Party, or the so-called Freedom. October of 2014, they had six seats in the Rada. Now, much of what both Svoboda and the right sector say are not to be argued with. They reject openly any international agreement like the European Union or the IMF. Well, they could say that on paper all they want. That's certainly not reflected in their actions. They're vehemently anti-royalist, you know, whether it be a hetman or any other type of monarchy. That Russians are Tartars, which comes up now and again. And that their model for political rule is 1848 Central and Western Europe. And if you go to there, you have to know Ukrainian to read this, but the Israeli Knesset is how that's their model parliament. They initially had backed Yushchenko in 2004, but he didn't press the ethnic issue sufficiently. But the most troubling thing that the right sector has in its agenda is full ecumenism religiously. They believe that the so-called Greek Catholics, or the Unians, should merge with the Ukrainian Patriarch, the Kiev Patriarchate, to create a unified Ukrainian church, Christian church, I don't know what they call it, and of course to throw the Moscow Patriarchate out. Problem with that, although I've always been very sympathetic with the autocephalous movement when it's not run by Filaret, but Patriarch of Vladimir certainly was a legitimate patriarch. Their canonical backing has nothing to do with 1921, where they consecrated bishops without bishops. They were just priests. It came from the Tomos, from the Patriarch of Antioch, Gregorius IV, for the so-called Orthodox Church of Poland. Well, they just called it that to avoid irritating Russians. 80% of the members of this church were Ukrainians. It was clear that this was a Ukrainian autocephalous church. And this is the canonical line of these people. So it is not from 1921. They have a legitimate line. They're all calendars. They have a distinct tradition. And Patriarch Vladimir was vehemently anti-ecumenical in his writings that have been translated. I've read every word, and I have a paper out on him. He was in the Gulag. He mocked the World Council of Churches. And I've upbraided Vladimir Putin on his being enamored with the World Council of Churches. Why is the Moscow Patriarchate a part of this? What do they gain from this? His electoral base is not interested in this kind of thing. This is a globalist leftist body. I have no idea why. And same thing for Lukashenko in Belarus. Their electoral base doesn't support it, and yet they demand membership in it. The current Patriarch of Moscow, his whole education is really in the West, and is based on the World Council of Churches. This was a Rockefeller creation for the sake of the merger of all Christian sects into something that the regime can control. In my opinion, it's a huge error that Putin continues to make. And it's one of the great sins of the MP. So, and of course, recognition by Constantinople has nothing to do with being canonical. In fact, usually, in my opinion, being recognized by Constantinople hurts your claim to being canonical. That has been a Masonic body for many, many years. Regardless, this is the view of many Ukrainian nationalists, because it does have a Western and Union foundation. This merger of the so-called Greek Catholics and the autocephalous under the Kiev Patriarchate is what's, and they reject the other autocephalous church, used to be run by Metropolitan Mephodia, because they weren't anti-Russian. Metropolitan Mephodia, the Ukrainian autocephalous Orthodox Church, consecrated bishops for two Russian catacomb bodies. The first was synod under Metropolitan Vyacheslav of Moscow, now Alexei, who used to be bishop in Minnesota, and that of Metropolitan Raphael, who at one time I was in communion with many years ago, who's a very, very good man. Both of them traced their lineage to the Ukrainian autocephalous Orthodox Church and were in communion with them for a while because they have a pedigree that can't be denied. Going there kind of sets them apart. Now, they separated from them because of some of the modernist things, and it's perfectly legitimate, and this obsession with having Constantinople recognize it. But you'll see in the Right Sector's publication that they want nothing to do with, I can't think of who the Metropolitan is now, who succeeded Mephodia. But Mephodia was not anti-Russian whatsoever. Mephodia held the same Gogolian position that I do, that these are two brotherly Orthodox people. Ukraine should be independent and have its own patriarchate or independent church one way or another, but they should be part of the same civilizational space. The biggest problem that Ukraine had when it declared independence was that the entire economy was geared as a part of the Soviet Union. Every section of the old Soviet Empire had an economic purpose. These were specialized areas that, when you brought them together, created the Soviet economy. Separately, they don't make much sense. So independence really was a struggle because the entire economy was based on being a part of the Soviet Union. Nevertheless, they had a massive scientific establishment, specializing in, especially at chemicals, electrical work. It was an extremely impressive place. But the separation from Russia was an economic disaster. And anybody who wants greater ties with the Western world, whether it be the European Union or the IMF or the United States, is an utter fool. The West is in terminal decline. It is drowning in debt. What in the hell do they need Ukrainian products for? They can't buy the products that they're producing themselves. The products that they're outsourcing all over the world, they can't even buy that because of the level of debt. And now they want Ukrainian products? It's nonsense. It's absolute nonsense. The U.S. wants just another source of raw materials and sex slaves, which is really what Ukraine is to the oligarchy. And I want to note that Kolomoisky advocates reducing the population of Ukraine even further to 5 million with a dual language policy, Ukrainian and Hebrew. And that actually, that bill has been in the Rada before. So this is something that you know has to be taken very seriously, is that they're not, this is not an Orthodox party. Now, when Patrick Vladimir died in 94, he wasn't able to be buried in St. Sophia, and there was a riot there between his supporters and the police. I sided with the protesters. Because Patrick Vladimir was a traditionalist. He had been in the Gulag for many years. His son was recently murdered. His whole family, you know, when these guys went to the Gulag, it didn't end there. Their family was discriminated against. They all lost jobs and you couldn't socialize with them. It was absolutely miserable. And he knew this, and that just, you know, increased the psychological torture of any dissident. his wife had passed on. He had been Father Vasily at one time, and his wife passed on and became a monk. And he also condemned in no uncertain terms the current patriarch, Filaret. Filaret was KGB by his own admission. He was Ukrainian, but his purpose was to destroy the Ukrainian nationalist movement through the church. He was a part of the, of course, the Soviet system, the Soviet church. But then he was running for the office of patriarch, and he lost by one vote. And when that happened, he said, you know, you guys promised me the patriarchate for what I did. And suddenly, that very day, he became a Ukrainian nationalist. And with the considerable fortune that he had amassed over the years, he moved to Kiev and created this Kiev patriarchate. He killed Metropolitan Vladimir. I'm sorry, Patriarch Vladimir, and installed himself as patriarch. He is ultra-liberal. He is pure ecumenist. He wants organs. He wants... He's a non-believer. He's a KGB hack. And who became Ukrainian nationalist overnight. And Patriarch Vladimir understood that. He is not a Ukrainian nationalist. He's not really anything. He's a hack. Again, like so many of these guys, he has his own private army. Kolomoisky has his own intelligence service. He's close with the American Department of Defense. Filaret, and you know, to unify the two segments of the Ukrainian autocephalous Orthodox Church, all Filaret would have to do is resign. Because he's the only problem. The only reason you have all these fragments is because of him. People are a part of his church, either because they don't understand, they don't know. He has a wife and children that we see once in a while. Either people don't know that, or they like him because he's kind of mainstream, they like him because he has money, because he has a large organization, whatever it is, because he has good people. Like all Orthodox churches, they have good people who don't understand or don't want to understand. Certainly God doesn't punish them, but although his canonical background is impeccable, his present policies are outrageous. And needless to say, he supports the anti-terrorist operation, which is what they call the army's attack on eastern Ukraine. But Novorossiya, the movement in eastern Ukraine against the oligarchs, has really been the restrainer of the development of New Khazaria. And this is why those oligarchs are spending a fortune using their own private forces, because the Ukrainian army fell apart almost as soon as they went up against it. Remember, you know, up until fairly recently, you had the draft in the Soviet Union, and you even had a draft in Ukraine. And so, you know, healthy men have military experience there. They know how to shoot. They know how to take care of weaponry. And, but men in the army were not willing to shoot these people. Now, the riots explode in 2014. And I'd never seen anything more violent and more sickening in my life. Even if I supported them, they were vicious. Now, I found out later that they were taking drugs. The U.S. State Department was passing out a very powerful stimulant. I've mentioned that on this show before. That not only kept them up all night, but also numbed them from pain. It always surprised me, though. You know, the use of, you know, the killing of cops. They captured almost 80 of them total. But they were suspiciously in military formation. Protesters don't normally do this. But the IDF helped train the so-called protester. The news source, Israel 7, has a number of things on this. Combat training. They brought in people from Georgia and Azerbaijan. And the attacks on police forces were very, very well coordinated. Suspiciously well coordinated. Ultimately, the government pulled its support of the police. The police abandoned their posts, and the government had fled. That's very, very suspicious. because what they had in Kiev in February of 2014 was the specialized recruit forces, many of whom are trained in precisely this kind of operation. You had local Kiev police. You had federal police. You had their own Ministry of Defense. You had the Border Guard Service. You had paramilitaries, all operating to defend the government in Kiev. The greatest, according to estimates on the ground, the number of protesters involved in this kind of rioting was no more than 30,000. And it was shocking how poorly the police did, being, you know, very specialized. These people were absolutely out of control. They killed a bunch of cops. And what I don't understand is how 30,000, albeit well-organized rioters, were able to overthrow the system. The military were never called in, although given the numbers of police they had on hand, it would seem to be unnecessary. But the Maidan had its own self-defense units that had been combat trained and very well organized. I want to note, by the way, that as this is going on, the parliament in Crimea had asked for Russian military intervention at that point. Starting in February of 2014, Crimea was asking to be taken into Russia. Now, it doesn't take a lot to want to leave a sinking ship, that Ukraine's economy had completely been hollowed out, that there was no chance of recovery. It was like the initial vote for independence. I mean, who didn't want to get away from the Soviet Union? It wasn't necessarily an anti-Soviet vote. It just was the place is impoverished and is not going to recover. Crimea had the same view of Ukraine, and a huge percentage of the population, and of course the parliament wanted to be taken into Russia. This is 2014. Now, some might wonder, you know, you had these nationalist militias, all these different battalions and everything else. On paper, they sound good, with the exception of the religious issue. Although many of them are unions. So religiously, we have nothing to do. I have nothing to do with them. But Yarosh of the right sector said that he didn't like the notion that the European Union was the number one plank in this so-called Maidan movement, but he was willing to go along with it for the sake of the subsidies. And of course, it meant that at least that Yanukovych would be driven from power. I have an article out on the political thought of Yanukovych. He is no Putin, he is no Lukashenko, not by any means. His great sin was literally selling Eastern and Western Ukraine to oil companies. I've talked about that in this show before. Shell and Amoco, the Rockefeller oil firm. I'm sorry, I'm wrong. Chevron. And they bought large chunks of the Far East and the Far West for the sake of fracking or extracting gas from shale, which is a very delicate operation. And the treaty, which I've read in the original, is like a treaty between two governments. They had full police powers over these areas. Local government had no power. Everything that they wanted, any law that they wanted to pass, had to go through the corporations. The corporations had their own security services, which essentially took the place of a militia. And you had local, Ivano-Frankivsk, for example, had protested this vehemently. And one of the reasons that this is the case is that fracking takes a huge amount of water. It's a big reason to oppose it, because the amount of water it takes is often debilitating for the area. These treaties, at least the one I read with Shell, said that Shell now owns the water resources of the entire country. So wherever they want to go to get it, they have a right to it. And I'm assuming the same was the case with Chevron. And the rioting in 2014 drove them both out, so at least they did one thing positively. But this was the future of Ukraine. Unfortunately, Yanukovych desperately needed the money, and they gave him a huge sum. But what happened was there were two options available to him, or any government in Kiev. The first was the European Union, or at least some connection to the EU. I mean, there's no way that, that Ukraine is anywhere near the budgetary and economic standards that you need to be a part of the EU, or the customs union, or being a part of the Eurasianist movement, connecting Russia and China and Kazakhstan and Central Asia. Well, the problem is, and Yanukovych realized that the sort of reform that would be necessary to bring Ukraine anywhere near the European Union would be trillions of dollars. Same thing for NATO. If Ukraine or any country is going to be a part of NATO, their military has to be fully interchangeable with the rest of the NATO countries. Well, that can't be the case if you have old Soviet equipment. So the ridiculous amount of money that it would require to bring a country into NATO is simply impossible. Albania doesn't have a military, so bring them into NATO is just a symbolic matter. But much of the Soviets' armament industry was in Ukraine because of the scientific work there, and of course the metal, the Dnieper, that part of Donbass to the east is known for its coal and for its metalworking because of their complementary industries. It was prohibitive. And this is why he rejected the treaty and was looking towards the customs union. The West then panicked. We thought he was our man. But then there was something else going on. New Kazaria was hopelessly in debt. For being these tycoons, they're not very good at business. They owed Western banks a huge amount of money. And while they, of course, were fabulously wealthy, that was their private money. In terms of their business companies, they were in a lot of trouble. And to overthrow the state is essentially to give the country over to Western bankers in at least partial repayment of their debt. And this, I was saying this at the time, because everyone, that's Firtash and all these guys were, you know, Kolomoisky was deeply in debt. But the notion of New Kazaria could only work if someone like, well, if the Party of Regents was gone. The Party of Regents is, you know, not impressive, but at least they were better than the Orange Revolution. The violence of 2014 was shocking. Now, there was a truce. The 20th of February, the worst of the rioting was in February of 14. And there was a truce between the two sides. Only the right sector had rejected it, but overwhelmingly the Maidan leadership, the U.S. State Department, the Israelis had basically accepted the truce. And that's when these gunshots rang out. Now, snipers who killed a few people obviously were not acting in the interests of the government. In the U.S., I remember, like it was yesterday, the instantaneous blaming of the government for this. Without any evidence, without any real knowledge. If anyone was shot, they could have been shot by muggers for all they knew. But it didn't benefit the state. Obviously, anyone would immediately blame the government. It would inflame the protesters. It didn't do any damage. It certainly didn't frighten anyone. And of course, now there is absolutely not a shred of doubt that it was the New Kazaria that had hired these men. And it was necessary precisely to inflame the protesters, to bring more people to the square, to add a slight element of fear to the protesters. And I've seen, there's one very famous scene, some of you may know, where they drove the front loader truck into a line of policemen. Now, why the driver wasn't shot, I don't know. Because certainly that would have been, you know, it's attempted murder. I'm looking at footage of the protests. I watched it at the time. Attempted murder is constant. That the police were being held back on a regular basis. A policeman has every right to shoot someone who's trying to kill him. Rioting in Northern Ireland or South Korea isn't of this nature. There's always that underlying agreement that cops won't use guns if you don't try to kill us. And I'm not saying that Yanukovych was in on this, because he wasn't. But clearly, the morale in the police department and the various pro-government forces that were defending the place was very, very low. And when you have the U.S. government passing out drugs and telling it, of course, as you know, John McCain visited them and said to keep up the violence. And of course, you know, said, yeah, they're shooting you. So, you know, you really need to overthrow them now. You know, John McCain is, you know, certainly an enemy of Russia, and definitely declared war on Russia many, many times. As of this broadcast, he isn't dead yet, strangely enough. So the level of violence is something I've never seen in writing. And this is strangely similar to the Khazar military forces, which were known at the time, the Assyrian level levels of violence, that people would surrender just so they wouldn't have to deal with them. And mercenaries were hired precisely because they were so violent. I've been following political violence my entire life, and I've never seen rioting like this before. Of course, drugs were involved. I didn't see any tear gas ever being used. But I can only say that morale was low, but the police probably outnumbered the protesters, and there were numerous units flown in from all over the country. But when the president fled, the resistance had collapsed entirely. The Times of Israel, around the February and March of 2014, made it very clear that Khazaria was being built, and that Jews in Ukraine are Khazars. They make no reference to the Old Testament. You know, Jews don't take the Old Testament seriously at all, if you know anything about them. But they do take Khazaria seriously. And there's a reason why it's unknown to Americans. This is the forces behind the scenes. Israel is the public image, but Khazaria is the real power. That they have the right, according to the Times of Israel, to declare their own state there. That Zionism really is supposed to have been in the Crimea. On March 14th of 2014, Haaretz, the Israeli paper, ran a story entitled "When Jews Ruled Ukraine," and they made an explicit connection between the Khazar Empire and the present violence in Kiev. Gennady Kobnin, one of the Jewish oligarchs, more or less serving under Kolomoisky, I believe was the first to use New Khazaria explicitly in a speech. As of now, it's more an informal name, kind of like the Bilderbergs would be to the elite. New Khazaria is just a way that the oligarchs understand themselves and how they describe themselves. But it's gone beyond that kind of informal label and has gone now to an actual political program. The New Khazaria will include Dnepr, Zaporozhye, Kherson, Nikolaev, and Odessa. This area. Now, of course, Crimea is out of the question, because Crimea was going to be the centerpiece of New Khazaria, but that's simply not going to happen. I mentioned that as early as 2014, Crimeans were begging to be a part of Russia, get us off the sinking ship, and they would never recognize anything that the new government would do. And, you know, they were planning on invading the area and all this stuff. And when they became, when they were brought under Moscow, their standard of living immediately went up, because their savings, their wages automatically increased in value. Simply by the switch of currency. And the most important thing is that because now they were a part of the customs union, China promised billions of dollars in investment, and they're building a port. They're one of the largest that they've ever built, really going to completely transform the economy there. The New York Times triumphantly reported that the Chinese were going to be investing in Ukraine, and they were actually, you know, making fun of Putin, saying, look what's happening here, except that they didn't bother to mention that the Chinese said that the current government has to leave first, that it's so unstable, this government is so corrupt, that they're going to have to leave and give way to a pro-customs union government. Then we are quite willing to assist the economy. The Chinese have outplayed the Americans in Africa for this very same reason. They've gone in and they haven't used, they're willing to work with all forms of government. And because these aren't private banks, this is a state acting, they can offer much better terms than the Americans can, or the IMF. You know, the IMF, remember, that's just, the IMF doesn't really exist. It's just a consortium of private bankers. The IMF is just a, I mean, it's an institution, but it is no different than the collection of major banks that comprise it. So, you know, when you pay money back to the IMF, it gets divided up among the banks that initially gave the loan. But what's been happening, and I think some of you may have noticed this, is that the Ukrainian state operates on one principle, that we're the anti-Russian force in this area. If you don't prop us up, the Russians are going to invade and take all of Central Europe. So whenever Poroshenko or you know thinks that he's in trouble, he'll contact the State Department and say, oh my God, we have news of a Russian invasion planned. You better do something about this. But even there, Western governments and Western banks are tired of writing checks. They've been giving aid and assistance to Ukraine, knowing full well they'll never see that money again. The IMF is giving money for reconstruction they know they'll never see again. Ukraine has passed all kinds of anti-corruption legislation that they have no intention of following. Anti-corruption legislation implies, and I said this in my lecture on Albania, implies that corruption is an anomaly, that the government is, generally speaking, not corrupt, and therefore, in passing these laws, it will be able to excise the corrupt elements and get rid of it. But in Ukraine, the entire system is corrupt. The entire system is oligarchic. The president is an oligarch. So there's no non-corrupt element that could then erect this legislation in order to destroy the cancer of corruption elsewhere. It's not even corruption anymore. Because again, corruption implies that it's a healthy body that has, you know, decaying flesh somewhere that needs to be cut out. The gangrene has to be removed or else it can infect the whole body. No, the entire system is. In Albania, you have the same thing. It's not a government. It's a criminal gang that has taken over the levers of state power and just give the impression that it's kind of a normal state. But in the Ukrainian press and academic discussions of the subject, they refuse to talk about economics. All power in Ukraine comes from money, comes from banking, comes from fuel, comes from steel, comes from essentially asset stripping and heavy investments elsewhere. That's where the power is. This is what political parties are, so-called. But public debate doesn't talk about business practices. It talks about the power to the presidency, the powers of the prime minister. Who do cabinet ministers answer to? How much is proportional representation? How much is winner take all? Knowing that it has nothing to do with how power operates in Ukraine. You could put any form of government there, and it won't change how the system runs. I did a lecture on Skodopadze, my favorite Ukrainian politician, probably of all time, who came the closest to the ideal ruler of the country. I mentioned that he was a pro-Russian, but as hetman of the Cossack host, he was dedicated to an independent Ukraine, and that's what he achieved. And he achieved the recognition of most of the world for this. He, in the middle of the Russian Civil War, he built a thriving economy. So much so that he gave a huge loan to the White Armies. That's the kind of, you know, leadership that a legitimate Ukrainian nationalist can have. There was no question as to his Ukrainian nationalism. There's no question as to his orthodoxy. No question the fact that he was dedicated to an independent country. But one that understood that its culture, its future, its economic, you know, its strategic location all point to the East. Now, far more than back then, it's obvious that the future is to the East. Eurasianism, at the very minimum, is a recognition that the West is in terminal decline. Western capitalism is now in the final process of asset stripping. There's no real investment anymore because there's no reason to believe there's going to be a West anytime soon. The sanctions on the Russian Federation have been a boon for it. It's forced Russia to do what South Africa did in the 1960s and 70s, create its own structures. It's created its own credit system, its credit processing system, which is called MIR. And I'm looking at, in Cyrillic, I'm looking at the membership of this new system, and I see Citibank and American Express on there. Which is, by the way, illegal, because it's against the sanctions. But it shows you how little faith they have in the Western system, that they're joining the Russian credit processing systems. So there's no question that, you know, for these so-called nationalist government movements to want to join the EU or even just have relationship with the West economically, is laughable, and it destroys their claim to the national title. But the head of the Nora business complex, the head of the Shabbat in Ukraine, Shemuel Karnitsky, said that Russia was the eternal enemy of the Jew. He said that the new Amman is Russia in general and Vladimir Putin in particular. And so if there's any question as to Vladimir Putin, as to who he works for, that should answer it. The Chabad sect has made it very clear that the new Amman is Vladimir Putin personally. What we see the Antichrist as, they see Putin as. So now there is no doubt as to where he stands. That sect in Russia is very, very nice to Putin, because it's very dangerous for them to be otherwise, because he's the most popular man there. In closing, I want to remind the audience what happened on May 2nd, 2014. That was a march before a soccer game of pro-Ukrainian revolutionaries in Odessa. And they were met by a pro-Russian march of about 300. The official story is that they were overwhelmed. They didn't have the numbers. And they fled to the Regional Federation of Trade Unions building. Well, there were a holdup in there. The rioters burned the place down and killed everybody inside. The official numbers are that 42 died from burns from the fire, over 30 from smoke inhalation, and 10 from jumping out of the building. Now, the deputy of the Odessa Regional Council said it's well over 100. The fire department was called. It took them an hour to show up, even though they're just up the street. And they weren't allowed to operate. They cut the hoses, whatever it was. Yellow smoke was seen pouring out of the windows, meaning that they were using chemical weapons there. Water had been cut long before. So this is something that had been planned in advance. Now you have Orthodox people in Ukraine saying that this was the Chabad sacrifice for Nukazaria to come into existence. And that's gaining in popularity in Russia. And I think there is truth to this. It had been planned for some time. There are those who are saying over 700 people were killed in that riot. What people don't realize is that in all, that used to be the head, the Communist Party building, and all Communist Party structures had an escape tunnel in the basement, which should say something about that. And this had been sealed off, I mean, welded shut in advance. So this is something that was planned. And there was a medic there, Anastasia Polishuk, who said it was over 700. And she was a volunteer medic there at the time. And you have this, and people who were saying this have to end up fleeing the country. There was something mystical about this slaughter. That it had been planned. They were deliberately driven into that building. And the water was cut already. The escape tunnels that all those buildings had were welded shut. And the examination of the bodies says that they were not killed by fire. They were killed by chemical agents first. And then the place burned to the ground. That wasn't that far from the Shabbat headquarters there. And it's seen as a sacrifice for the building of New Khazaria. And that happens to be my opinion. And information continues to come out concerning Shabbat's role in that killing. So that will show you once and for all what Putin is, what the revolution in New Russia really is, and what the Ukrainian so-called revolution in Kiev was in 2014. If you don't accept it, then you're a moron, or that you're deliberately being misled for some other twisted reason. And it's one of the most significant political events in the 21st century, and is going to be defining this century from here on in. Anyway, I appreciate all my listeners. As always, I ask for your financial support. I do this full time. I have the IRS on my back. I really don't want to lose my house. I beg of you to donate to me and my site, rusjournal.org. You can click and it will go to my PayPal account. I thank you very, very much for all those who have already donated. Thank you very much. I've gone over my hour, so I'll end this now. I thank you again, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.